WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. Tomorrow marks the 20th anniversary of Elvis Presley's death. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we pay tribute to the king of rock and roll. Our guest is Peter Guralnick, author of The Last Train to Memphis, which may be the definitive story of Elvis's early years. It's the first in a projected two-volume biography. Guralnick says he wants to rescue Elvis from his detractors, his admirers, and the dreary bondage of myth. Terry spoke with him in 1994. They started their conversation with the story of Elvis's first recording. When Elvis was 18, hoping to get discovered, he went to the fledgling Sun Studio in Memphis, where, for $3.98 plus tax, you could make your own record. This is the one he made.
Evening shadows make me blue. When each weary day is through, how I long to be with you. My happiness, every day I reminisce, dreaming of your tender kiss, always thinking how I miss my happiness. Men, years it seems have gone by since we shared our dreams, but I'll hold you again. There'll be no blue memories then.
Elvis recorded this hoping that it would give him an in at Sun Records. He wanted this to be his audition. So what did Sam Phillips, the founder of Sun Records, have to say when he heard what Elvis had done?
Pretty much nothing. Not at that time. I mean, I think on Elvis's part, it was an unrealistic hope. And what he got out of it, ultimately, was he got a two-sided acetate. The other side was That's When My Heartaches Begin. And he went home with it, and he played it himself. His parents played it. I'm sure everyone marveled at it. He played it for his friends. And he stored it away, eventually. What this probably led to was a revamping of his thinking. And all through the fall of 53, he continued, at least as Marion Kiesker remembers it, and Marion Kiesker was Sam Phillips's assistant, the office manager at Sun Records. And Marion recalls him coming in over the fall, and Sam also has memories of Elvis over the succeeding months. He came back in again in January of 54, made another acetate, and again nothing happened. And it wasn't until the spring of 54, I think until May of 54, that he finally got a call from Sam Phillips. And this came about as a result of both Marion Kiesker and Sam Phillips noting about Elvis that he was a good ballad singer and that maybe someday, and I'm sure this was also promoted by Elvis's return visits to the studio just to check in, see what was going on, but each of them had noted that Elvis was a good ballad singer. And eventually he got a ballad called Without You, which he had picked up at the Tennessee State Prison over in Nashville. He didn't have a singer for it, and he called Elvis back in.
And so Elvis comes in because Phillips thinks that he has the right voice to record this ballad, and then Phillips doesn't like the way Elvis sings it.
That's right. And again, the interesting thing in terms of this whole issue of cultural theft is that the ballad that he recorded does not resemble in the least anything to do with black music, the African-American tradition. It may very well be a black singer who is singing it, but it could as easily be Dennis Day as the Ink Spots. And Elvis's attempts at it haven't been preserved, at least not as far as anyone knows. But it was obvious that they didn't get anywhere with this ballad. Sam evidently asked Elvis to try other songs. Elvis probably threw in every song he knew, which were mostly, but what he sang for Sam that day was almost entirely ballads. It would be Dean Martin's songs by Dean Martin, songs by Billy Eckstein, songs by the Ink Spots, but nothing, again, nothing whatsoever resembling rock and roll. And I think at the end of the day, there was a feeling of great frustration on Elvis's part. I mean, just terrible disappointment. And on Sam's part, there remained the kernel of the idea that this kid is different. He has a different sound. There may be something. What is there? You know, there's something there that can be gotten. And out of that, Sam put him together with Scotty Moore and Bill Black, and said, "Why don't you guys try something with him and see what happens?"
Scotty Moore, the guitarist, and Bill Black, the bass player.
That's right. Yeah.
So the three of them come back into the studio, and they ended up, instead of doing more ballads, they end up putting out a single that on one side has Blue Moon of Kentucky, which was a Bill Monroe tune, something out of bluegrass, and on the other side had That's All Right, a kind of rhythm and blues thing by Arthur Crudup. How did they end up with that selection, considering Elvis had been pegged as a ballad singer?
I think nobody was more surprised than Sam Phillips, Scotty Moore, or Bill Black. I mean, they came to this out of sheer desperation, I think, on Elvis's part. Elvis met Scotty. He went over to Scotty Moore's house on a Sunday, Sunday, July 4th, as far as I can determine. On Monday night, they went into the studio. They really just ran through a bunch of songs. They ran through the same kinds of songs that Elvis had done for Sam Phillips in the studio previously. On Monday night, they went into the studio, and you can hear some of the early attempts, like Harbor Lights or I Love You Because, which were just pure ballads. Eventually, they were brought out years later by RCA. But it was evident by everyone's account that the session was completely falling apart. They were no more on the verge of success than Elvis had been in his initial tryout. And they took a break, and I think it was just in a moment of sheer desperation that Elvis, everybody's drinking Cokes, and all of a sudden Elvis just starts flailing away on the guitar and singing That's All Right, Mama. When Elvis started playing That's All Right, Scotty and Bill fell in and started playing along, and I'm sure it was very ragged, but Sam Phillips opened up the control room door, and he said, "What are you guys doing?" And they said, "I don't know." And Sam said, "Well, whatever it is, let's back up and do it again."
Well, let's hear Elvis doing That's All Right.
Well, that's all right, Mama. That's all right for you. That's all right, Mama. Just any way you do, that's all right. That's all right, now, Mama, anyway do. Well, Mama, she done told me, Papa done told me too. Son, that gal you foolin' with, she ain't no good for you. But that's all right, that's all right. That's all right.
I guess you really have to give Sam Phillips credit for hearing what it was that made Elvis Elvis and not trying to fashion him into, you know, somebody else's mold.
I think you have to give Sam Phillips enormous credit, not only for hearing, which is unique enough in itself, but for waiting.
Right,
for
right.
For not imposing himself on Elvis or on Elvis's style. This is really at least a two-tiered story, and probably more, because I think that Scotty and Bill had a great deal to contribute as well. But the thing is that Elvis was a person of such broad musical intelligence. He was someone of so many different musical interests. Marion Kiesker described how, on the first acetate, he went through 12 different styles in the course of one song. And I think you can hear him straining on some of the ballads that came out from those sun years. You just hear all these different voices and all these different gropings, in a sense, towards his own style. It was with That's All Right and Blue Moon of Kentucky, and then rolling on from there, you can hear someone discovering his own voice, instantly. It's almost as if it came to him instantly, and it was his voice. It was not the voice that Sam Phillips, there was no imposition in it. It was not Sam Phillips saying, hey, you should record a blues, but it was Sam Phillips waiting until that moment happened and then saying, that's it.
My guest is Peter Gorelnick, author of a biography of Elvis Presley called Last Train to Memphis. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Peter Gorelnick, the author of Last Train to Memphis, The Rise of Elvis Presley. In your book, you really treat Sam Phillips with enormous respect.
Yeah, I think it's one of those remarkable accidents of history that a person of such unique talent as Elvis should be thrown in with a person of such equally unique gifts as Sam Phillips. I mean, you have really the meeting in Sam Phillips, you have someone who's as close to a genius as anyone I've ever met, and you have his a person of just unswerving vision and dedication to the music. What's also interesting about the Elvis Presley story is that when Colonel Parker comes into the story, you have a person of an entirely different kind of genius, but you have someone who, in terms of entrepreneurship, in terms of marketing, in terms of is as focused, as driven, and as single-minded as Sam Phillips was with respect to the music, and you had an enormous conflict.
Colonel Tom Parker had already entered the record world by the time he took over Elvis's contract. What did he see in Elvis? What did he want Elvis for?
I think he saw him as a phenomenon that was happening. He witnessed it. He set up a tour early in 55, and he saw the phenomenon happening on that tour. He saw Elvis taking the show from his star act, Hank Snow, whom he was managing exclusively and with whom he was in a booking agency partnership. He saw the thing building. And just as Sam Phillips had recognized the potential in terms of music, just as Sam Phillips had recognized the musical potential, Tom Parker recognized not just the sales potential, but the phenomenological potential. I mean, this thing was happening in a way that nothing had happened before, and it was happening with a speed that nothing had ever happened before, at least not in his experience and not in most people's experience. So from late spring of 55, he was clearly in the picture in terms of trying to wrest the management contract from Bob Neal and get the recording contract from Sam Phillips.
When Parker brought Elvis to RCA, how did that change his sound?
It changed his sound a great deal, only because nobody at RCA knew how to record him. The Colonel had no interest in music. I don't mean to say he had no interest in music. I think he was a passionate advocate of Elvis in every way. And if Elvis had recorded in Lithuanian, the Colonel would have sought the best way to record Lithuanian Lithuanian language records. But it's a mistake to see him as influencing Elvis's sound per se. What really influenced Elvis's sound was that Sam Phillips had evolved a method, and he had also worked out a way of pushing Elvis, not pushing is perhaps the wrong word, but of either inspiring Elvis or creating a climate in which Elvis could find his own voice and find his own style. At RCA, Steve Scholes was the person who essentially signed Elvis to RCA. Steve Scholes was a person who noted down the times. He was an A&R person. He suggested songs, but most of the songs he suggested Elvis found inappropriate. And he didn't have either a great deal creatively to contribute to Elvis, nor did he know Elvis, which was a very important point for somebody who sought reassurance. I mean, Elvis sought reassurance. He was looking for some form of approbation, and Steve Scholes didn't have it to give.
Peter, I'd like you to choose one of the RCA sessions that Elvis recorded that you think shows something about what changed for him at RCA when Sam Phillips wasn't around to help Elvis keep discovering his Elvisness.
I think a good example, and it doesn't have anything to do with the technical side, is his recording of Blue Suede Shoes. I'm sure that the reason that he recorded it was because it was such a huge hit for Carl Perkins. RCA was nervous that they had signed the wrong artist by getting Elvis rather than Carl, and probably this was Steve Scholes' idea. But the thing is, if you listen to the recording that Elvis did, which I loved at the time and continue to love, it never gets the groove. He never gets past the point. It's taken too fast. It's evident, as Elvis later said, that he simply didn't feel that he could beat Carl Perkins' version. But more than that, it just never grooves in on that inner, that you listen, for example, on the Million Dollar Quartet, and you hear him talking about Jackie Wilson's version of Don't Be Cruel, and he sings it over and over and over and over again. And I think that's how he heard a song, was just by, he would hone in on it. And with Blue Suede Shoes, it stopped several steps too short.
Why don't we hear Blue Suede Shoes?
Great.
Well, it's one for the money, two for the show, three to get ready, now go, cat, go, but don't you step on my blue suede shoe. Well, you can do anything but take me over my blue suede shoe. Well, you can knock me down, step in my face, slander my name all over the place. Well, do anything that you want to do, but not, honey, lay off them shoes. And don't you step on my blue suede shoe. Well, you can do anything but take
when
me
Elvis
over
started
my
producing
blue
himself at RCA after his early sessions there, what changed for him?
What changed, I think, was that he was driving the session. It was at the July 2nd, 1956 session that produced Hound Dog and Don't Be Cruel that he really took over the reins for the first time altogether. And the thing was that I think that it was at this point that he was given directions, may be the wrong word, but he was leading the musicians. He was suggesting where he wanted to go. He was suggesting voicings. He was saying, when Steve Scholl said at the end of Take 18 or something that, I think we've got it now, Elvis said, no, let's keep going, and he went on for 31 takes. He allowed his own artistic vision to take precedence for the first time, and essentially, here he was at 21. He was running his own sessions.
Why don't we listen to Don't Be Cruel?
Okay.
You think this is a good record for him?
I think that for the first time he was at RCA he was singing in his own voice. I think that it's very different than the Sun records he made. It's much more of a pop record, but this was the direction in which he had been looking to evolve from the moment he first stepped into a studio. So that while it may not be as much to my taste as Mystery Train, say, it's a moment in which he's discovered his own Elvis voice once again.
You know I can be found sitting home all alone. If you can't come around, at least please telephone. Don't be cruel to who heart is true. Baby, if I made you mad for something I might have said, please don't forget my past. Future looks bright ahead. Don't be cruel to who heart is true. I don't want no other love, baby, it's just you I'm thinking of. Don't stop the hate.
Your book ends with Elvis in the army boarding the ship that's going to take him overseas to Germany. And there's a lot of press and fans and so on there. In fact, let me play a little bit of a press conference that I held right before he set sail.
Here at the Brooklyn POE, where Elvis Presley, Private Elvis Presley of the United States Army, is due to embark for Germany today. And let me tell you just a little of what the hubbub is like here. We've been, as I say, waiting for the past 2 hours for Presley to come in. There was some delay with his train. Now Elvis moves over and is going to sit down behind the desk. The microphones will be brought in. More pictures will be taken. Elvis apparently enjoying the whole thing very much. He's been in smiles since he walked into the room.
Now Elvis, if rock and roll die off between now and the time you get out of service.
I'll starve to death, sir.
Back there.
I beg your pardon.
What do you think you might do? May we have that jump
rope? If rock and roll music were to die out, which I don't think it will, I would try something else. I would really probably go in for the movies then. I would try to make it as an actor, which is very tough because you got a lot of competition.
Peter, would you describe to us a little bit about what that day was like for Elvis?
It's a perfect example of the dutiful Elvis carrying out his sense of behaving correctly in public while feeling utterly forlorn and lost inside. I think there was a sense on his part, his mother had just died. Here he was on display. He's feeling as if, as he has told many of his close friends, he feels as if his career is gone at the moment of greatest triumph. The most terrible things have happened to him. And yet here he is on stage in front of all these people, all these adults, who really don't particularly wish him well, presenting a smiling, dutiful exterior image, saying all the things that he should say, never breaking his composure, never breaking, and expressing his patriotism and a sense of duty. It's not simply a remarkable performance. I mean, it expresses some of his very best qualities, and it also expresses some of the qualities which, in a sense, crippled him.
Peter Guralnick speaking with Terry Gross in 1994. His book, The Last Train to Memphis, is the first in a projected 2-volume biography of Elvis Presley. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.